Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, adjuncts and alumni. The recording you're about to hear was recorded on Thursday, the 31st of July, 2025, at the Bendigo Library on the unceded country of the Djadjawarong and Tungurung people of the Kulin Nation. The recording you're about to hear was made on the 19th of August at the La Trobe University Library in Melbourne, Australia, on unceded Wurundjeri land. It was part of the university's Launches at the Library series. In this conversation, award-winning science journalist and former Vice-Chancellor's Fellow at La Trobe University, Dr. Elizabeth Finkel, discusses her latest book, Prove It, A Scientific Guide for the Post-Truth Era, with science educator and La Trobe's own Douglas Baer. They delve into the role and function of the scientific method in a post-truth era, exploring how evidence-based theories underpin our legal, academic, and political institutions and public conversations. I hope you enjoy. Hello, everybody, and welcome. Thank you all for coming along. My name is Kelly Gardner. I'm a writer and I taught creative writing here at La Trobe for many years. I'd like to start by acknowledging the fact that we're on Woiwurrung country here, the country that was never ceded, and I'd like to pay my respects to the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung elders, past and present, and also to their storytellers. So this event today is part of our Literary La Trobe program, which includes Writers on Campus and Launches at the Library. And you can catch up on recordings of our previous events on the Literary La Trobe podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. But today is a launch celebrating our library, celebrating our community of writers and new works published by La Trobe University Press, which is why we're here today to welcome award-winning science journalist Elizabeth Finkel to discuss her latest book, Prove It, A Scientific Guide for the Post-Truth Era, published by La Trobe University Press only last week, I think. So congratulations.
Thank you.
It really is a launch. Elizabeth holds a PhD in biochemistry and spent 10 years as a research scientist before becoming a science journalist and author. She is the founding editor of Cosmos magazine and a regular contributor to the US magazine Science, Radio National's Science Show, and The Monthly. Her award-winning books include The Genome Generation and Stem Cells Controversy at the Frontiers of Science, and she's also a former Vice-Chancellor's Fellow. Yeah. To help us talk through the role and function of the scientific method in the past and in our current political climate, Elizabeth is in conversation today with science educator and presenter, La Trobe's engagement officer, Douglas Baer. Please welcome them both and relax.
Thank you so very much. I too want to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional owners, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung. The First Peoples of Australia are the first storytellers here in Australia. And it's actually not just storytellers, but the first observers of the skies, the lands, and the waters. And as scientists, we can actually take a look at those stories and observations and help us inform on science. I am so incredibly excited today to be speaking to you, Elizabeth, or Ella, as hopefully friends can call you, and on your new book, Prove It. You are an absolutely powerhouse of science communication here in Australia. So thank you so very much for joining us today. It's been actually a couple of years before since you've published a book. You've been an editor at Cosmos. You've published long-form articles on current scientific stories. What's compelled you to go back to this medium after a little bit of time off?
So I was the editor of Cosmos magazine for six years. And then when I stepped down from that role, I thought, what am I going to do? So I thought, well, I like writing books. My previous two books were kind of on a single topic. And I thought, I don't really want to do that again. I enjoyed dancing across the universe, as one does if you're in editor of a popular science magazine, you have to be across everything. A metaphor I like to think of is, and I got this from Roger Short, which some of us lucky people will know of Roger. And he would say that a research scientist is like a carrot. They have to go down deep and narrow. You know, you really have to run just to keep up with you, keep in place with your what's going on with your own field. Whereas he always described himself as preferring to be a sprawling cabbage. And that's what I got to be when I became an editor. I really, you know, I became more like a sprawling vine. I had to be across everything, and it was truly exhilarating. I think anybody who's been a research scientist is kind of, you know, why do you become a research scientist? Because you love knowledge. You've got wanderlust. But then you find, oh, God, you know, I have to just spend all my energies every moment of the working day just to keep up with my own little narrow field. So it was tremendously liberating and exhilarating to be editor of the magazine and try to be across everything from theoretical physics to, I know, nanotech. So when I stepped down from being the editor, I thought, well, it'd be good to somehow keep that breadth. And between various discussions between myself and the editor at Black Ink, Chris Speak, we came up with this idea of looking at scientific proof, even though the word proof is not part of the vocabulary of science, but proof in the sense of testing theories to destruction. That's just like proving concrete, you know, testing concrete. And my other desire to write the book was, so it was 2019, first Trump administration. And what happens at Trump's first inauguration? You know, it was a rainy day, you know, there were hardly anybody there. Well, you know, certainly the seats were not filled. And Trump says, it was, you know, the biggest inauguration crowd in history. And everybody went, ah, this is a president who lies. Brazenly, and you know, one of his political advisors says, "Oh, you know, this is just alternative facts." So we were well and truly. It was sort of like the declaration of the post-truth era, and I thought, well, maybe if I write these stories that show how scientific proof works, because one of the dictums of journalism is "don't tell, show," and this is showing how science works across these five different areas. And why did I pick so many different areas? Because as an editor at Cosmos, I had this sense that the way science is done across the different disciplines is not the same way I did it as a biochemist. There's something different about the way these theoretical physicists are operating than the way I did. So I wanted to explore that across the sciences. And so that was one of my questions starting out. I felt a bit like I was starting a thesis, and that was one of my questions. And my other question was, how is science different now in the 21st century compared to the 20th century when we had most of our philosophers of science like Karl Popper, Thomas Kuhn, and so on? You know, in the 20th century, theories were big, data was small. In the 21st century, data is vast. And where, you know, theories are almost shrinking in there. So I wanted to, those were sort of my two starting questions.
And prove it is a, you know, a paddock of different types of science, if you will. It is looking out that broad sense. So you take the reader on a journey of five different stories of science, starting off with the origins of COVID, moving on to the origins of humans, then continuing to evidence-based medicine, and your final two chapters, the second to the penultimate, is on human consciousness, which when you read it, folks, don't try to do that one at night right before going to bed. It tests the brain juices quite a bit. And then finally on gravitational waves. So it does seem like it's a, you know, it's a wide kind of section of the pie of science. When having such that wide kind of section, what is the kind of the unifying way that you can look at all of these stories, or that lens that you look through to link them together, the bigger picture, if you will?
Right. So, you know, as I said from the outset, I didn't know where this journey was going to lead me. I was kind of following my nose. I could have picked 100 different theories to write about. To make the cut, it had to be a sort of theory that had a pointy end in this moment, that was a consequential theory. And very importantly, could I tell a story about it? Because if I can't tell a story, nobody's going to read this book. What's the point? So I certainly didn't have a master plan going in about how these theories would all fit some grand unified, you know, umbrella. So I sort of followed my nose. And I suppose two things. So I will get to your main question, is what unifies them. I had to ask myself this question at the end. Okay, what unifies all this? I think, as I was working my way through, so my first chapter was on looking at the story of gravitational waves, and you have to look at the theory of general relativity. And I really thought this chapter would read like a triumphal march, because that's how we reported it at Cosmos magazine when I was the editor, and everybody else did. Einstein comes up with this theory in 1915, general relativity. It sort of picks up where Newton left off. Newton gives us an explanation of how gravity works. He gives us all the data so that we can, you know, make predictions. But he says, hypothesis no finger. I'm not going to make a hypothesis about a theory. This is too weird, all this force acting across, you know, the universe. How, I don't have a theory to explain this, but here's the data. Let's just work with the data. And Einstein comes along in 1915, a few hundred years later, and he does come up with a theory of gravity, and that's his theory of general relativity. And I could digress, but I won't. So going back. Okay, so I thought this would read like a triumphal march. 1915. Theory of general relativity predicts gravitational waves. 100 years later, exactly, we find them. Whoa. Whoa. I mean, is there a more incredible story? And there are so many nuances to this story. I mean, the machinery that was developed to find these gravitational waves defies belief, because gravitational waves are vibrations in the fabric of space-time. So if you think of space-time as something like Lycra, and something huge happens somewhere out there, hundreds of thousands of light years away, if it's big enough, like the collision of two black holes, you'll pick up the reverberations on the shores of planet Earth. But they will be tiny, and they will be the stretching and squeezing of space-time by the dimensions of 1/10,000th the nucleus of a proton. An atom small, a proton is inside an atom much smaller. We're talking 1/10,000th the diameter of a proton. Space-time will stretch and squeeze. Really? Really? You can really develop an instrument to do this? Well, they did. I would never have touched that area of science. No way. But there are those crazy scientists out there that spent decades of their lives against huge resistance, against dismissive statements like you might as well try to pick up the flapping of an angel's wing, or, you know, this is, you know, just ridiculous. They do it for 10 years. They pick up nothing. They ask Congress for more funding to make the instrument more sensitive. Against the better judgment of lots of scientists, they get it. They turn on their advanced LIGO in 2015, they pick it up. It's an astonishing story. So to get back to your point, I thought it would read like a triumphal march, and it wasn't. Einstein's theory predicts the gravitational waves. But what about Einstein? He says, no, I don't think my theory predicts gravitational waves. You're thinking that by analogy with electromagnetic force, produces electromagnetic waves and that gravitational force should therefore produce gravitational waves. But gravity and electromagnetism, they're so different. No. I don't think gravitational waves exist. And he tries many times to prove they do not exist. And he gets proven wrong. And so it's up to the 1960s for some really out there scientists to pick up the pieces. And yeah.
So he tries to prove it wrong. He doesn't. But this is kind of what you introduce in the introduction, is that way that you would like people to read this book isn't necessarily about proving something, but it's more along the lines of that the science philosopher Popper, who says to look at it in a different way. And you're actually asking us as the reader to read the book with that kind of philosophy of science in mind. You want to share with us how that affinity with Popper's story might, you know, help us also read this book?
I have to say the philosophy of science had to be retrofitted, because I went into the book thinking, I know at some point I'm going to have to, you know, engage with the philosophy of science. And it was a terrifying proposition, because for those of us who've read philosophy, it's not simple. So, you know, I thought, well, I'll deal with that once I finish the book. You know, I thought I would finish the book maybe in a year. I budgeted 3 months per chapter, so, you know, maximum 2 years. Well, 5.5 years later, I'm still working my way through the chapters. And I thought, oh, how am I going to deal with philosophy of science? And then I realized it was there all along. I just had to look for it. So Popper, where did I discover Popper? Well, let me go back to Einstein, because that was the chapter I did first. So how does Einstein even come up with his crazy, crazy theory of relativity? And in a nutshell, what is the theory of relativity? Every speed in the universe is relative to something. You ride your bike and relative to the road, it's, you know, 10 k's per hour, but relative to the bike next to you, it might be 1 kilometer per hour. Every speed is relative, except for this one speed in the universe, which is not relative, which is the speed of...
Space and class time, yeah.
Speed of light. And this comes out of, what's his name? Anyway, his name will come to me in a second. The Maxwell's equations. Maxwell's trying to figure out, you know, the relationship between magnetism and electricity. What comes out at the end? It's a wave, and it's a wave with exactly the speed of light. So that's when the world realizes, oh, light is an electromagnetic wave. And whoa, and its speed is not relative to anything. It has troubled Einstein deeply. And, you know, we've all seen these cartoons of him riding his bicycle trying to catch up with a light wave and thinking, how come it doesn't matter how fast I pedal, that light wave will still be speeding off at 300,000 kilometers per second. So how does he solve this problem? Well, when he's a patent clerk in Switzerland, he forms this philosophy club with two colleagues, and they start reading books of philosophy, including David Hume's philosophy, a treatise on human nature. And he reads David Hume's warning on induction. Now, induction means that if you observe something 1,000 times, 100,000 times, 1,000,000 times, you assume, okay, it's going to happen the million and oneth time. And this is the way pretty much all science works, you know, with probabilities based on how many times you've observed it. But Hume's warning is, just because you've observed these things 1,000,000 times, there's no law that says you will observe it for the 1,000,000th time. Don't confuse probability with the law of the universe. And Einstein's thinking about this. Okay, all right, so just because a meter has always been a meter, just because a second has always been a second, there is no law that says that must be the case. And maybe when you're traveling close to the speed of light, things change. And that solves the conundrum of relativity. So when he's pedaling on his bicycle trying to catch up to a light beam, whoa, distance contracts, a meter contracts, and time dilates. And so he can never catch up to that light beam. It's just, you know, diminishing returns the faster he goes. So that pops out of my first chapter, but I sort of let it lie. I thought, oh, that's interesting, but I let it lie. I was only struck over the head with philosophy when I did my chapter on COVID origins, which, by the way, was never meant to be a chapter in my book. But whenever it was 2022 or 2023, when the front page of The Australian was plastered with this story that said, science has been sidelined and Anthony Fauci is part of conspiracy and COVID really started in a lab and was written by Shari Marks and based on her interviews with people of the former, the first Trump administration. And I thought, and my husband at the time was chief scientist and he showed me this article on the front page of The Australian and he said, look at this, it's front page of Australian. You know, there must be something to this. I'm going, what? I spent several months. I could not fact check the article because there were no facts in there. It was all based on her interviews with certain members of the first Trump administration. Well, okay, I believe your interviews, but that's kind of their opinions. Show me some facts I can check, some evidence I can actually check other than people's opinions. And I couldn't. So I went back and I started digging up all the literature that around this area. And I felt I had to put something into the public debate as a riposte. Strangely, there was very little coming from the Australian science writers. I think, you know, were people scared of the Australian? What was going on? I really couldn't figure that out. But anyway, I did my research, felt very confident with it, wrote up a story for the monthly, and then Chris Feek, my editor, said, you should write this up for the book. And so I did. And I'm really glad I did because then I delved into it all over again. And I saw something extraordinary, that the scientists who were very prominent and, for instance, the scientists who first came up with the idea that COVID could have started in a lab, who included Eddie Holmes at University of New South Wales and Christian Anderson at the Salk Institute, and they were the ones who got Fauci in on this, you know, telephone conference with 12 other experts. And they put it to Fauci and they said, look, we think we've got the genome, you know, the code for the new virus. We can see two little tweaks that have made this virus that would explain why this virus is much more transmissible than the 2002 equivalent of this virus. This looks like it could have been done in a lab, these two little discrete tweaks. And, you know, the 12 experts say to them, look, we see why you think this, but we're not convinced. For instance, one of the sites you think could have been made in a lab, it's just one letter of DNA that has been changed. You know, go back and get more evidence and then write something up, write a letter to the science community. You know, the very next day, one of Eddie Holmes' colleagues at the University of Hong Kong sends him the genome, the code of a virus, a coronavirus that was extracted from a pangolin, one of the most trafficked animals in the world. And it's got one of those altered sites in it. So they go, okay, that takes care of that one. It's nature made it. More, you know, there's no reason to think a lab made it because nature has come up with it. And then when they looked more carefully at that single site that they thought had been made in a lab, they really changed their view on that too. They realized, they thought that this, that it had been created through, might have been created through the culture of cells. It's a detailed story. It's in the book. But bottom line is this was the furin cleavage site. And it turns out if you make, if you try to engineer a virus in culture, it throws out that purine cleavage site. So all the evidence weighed against a laboratory origin. So they had falsified their own theory. That's a term from Karl Popper. Disprove, falsify. You know, I hadn't twigged to it at the time. But months later, Christian Anderson was hauled up to a House Senate subcommittee, a Republican-led House Senate subcommittee. And they, see, let me backtrack two steps. So when they had found all these two extra pieces of evidence, that led them to think, no, it's much more likely this virus was made in nature than in a lab. And so they write a paper, a letter to Nature Medicine outlining why they think what they do. And you think, well, that would be, you know, that's a scientific method. New data, you revise what you originally thought. No, it becomes the spark for a conspiracy theory, because what the narrative is that, oh, you went into this meeting with Anthony Fauci believing it was made in a lab. You come out of this meeting with Anthony Fauci and you say, no, the weight of evidence is that it came from nature, conspiracy. And by the way, we know that Anthony Fauci was funding the Wuhan Institute of Virology. True. His institute was funding it to the, you know, grand sum of $100,000 a year. But that's how the conspiracy was formed. And so the Republican subcommittee picks this up and they're interrogating Christian Anderson and they've subpoenaed his emails and his chats. And at one point, one of the House members reads out, look, what we found in your email. We were trying to disprove the lab origin theory. Smoking gun, you see. You were trying to disprove it, conspiracy. And then Christian Anderson had to explain, no, actually, this is the scientific idea of falsification. You put up your own theory and then you try to kill it. So I realized, oh, look at that. Philosophy of science is alive. Even though I'd never encountered it as a working scientist, this was guiding the philosophical framework of these scientists in COVID origins.
I was struck by, and I didn't know beforehand, how quickly people acted on this and how quickly the science came into consultation. And I think that's proven time and time again throughout the five stories throughout this, is that good science is about scrutinizing the data. It's about collaboration and changing your mind, too. We didn't want to hear people changing their mind at the beginning of COVID. We wanted definites. We wanted certainties and stuff like that. And unfortunately, with science, we don't have that, do we? That sense of certainty. There is always a little bit of uncertainty of it. And I want to go back onto that thinking about that collaborative nature of science and stuff like that.
I don't agree. It's collaborative.
You don't agree. Okay.
No.
All right.
No, the essential culture of science is combat. Anybody here a scientist? Do you agree? You don't?
No. I mean, look, I think there's a combative element there that science works ultimately by collaboration. And sometimes that is people coming together to butt heads, but it's to get to the answer right.
Have you ever had a paper published?
Yep.
Did you have to get it peer reviewed?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's good. your worst competitors are going to judge you and you'll run this gauntlet, but ultimately they make it better.
I exaggerate this. Of course, there is collaboration, but for me, what stands at the forefront is this contest, this constant contest of ideas, which lies at the heart of the way we create knowledge. The contest. Are we at a university?
Yeah.
The contest of ideas. I think you have to wait, Freddie.
The subject.
Oh, okay.
Okay, how about presenting the degree of uncertainty in terms that the public can understand?
Yes, yes. So agreed. So I think, you know, quickly, how do I sniff something that looks scientific versus non-scientific? When somebody gives me a black and white answer, no, that's not science. When somebody gives me an answer couched in degrees of certainty and caveats, that's starting to sound like science to me. And I just want to, you know, stress the idea of contest, because I think that is hidden from the public.
Yep.
There's this whole subterranean, you know, workings of science. And, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, somebody comes and talks to the public. They have to give some sort of an answer, right? But, you know, it's like predicting the weather. You do, you know, well, we have a 95% certainty that it's going to be sunny today. I'd say 100% certainly.
No clouds in the sky.
Yeah. So I don't know if they do it here, but I lived in America for several years. That was all the way the weather was always couched in probability.
And it's accepted too. I mean, that's the paradox is something like weather. It, people understand it's a probability to a certain degree.
Yes.
Not necessarily if you're really wanting to hang up your sheets or not outside.
Yeah.
You want 100% chance that it's going to be sunny and they're not going to be rained on. But like, why is it that weather we could possibly have that acceptance of a probability, but it seems to be lacking with other things, particularly with human health and you know, it might or might not work. We want it to work, right? As far as a medical treatment or something like
that. Well, in my experience, you know, more and more doctors are trained in evidence-based medicine. Some of them clearly are not. You know, I think doctors try to give it to you straight these days, you know. God forbid you have cancer, they will give you the statistics. God forbid you have, you know, pneumonia. Doctors try to be very evidence-based these days. But to your point, and I think, so I had an article in The Conversation a week ago, and I got a lot of feedback from it. Most of it positive, but I won't mention names, but a couple of people pushing back saying science overreached during COVID. And that really has given me a lot of food for thought, because certainly in America and certainly I think also in Australia, judging by the feedback I got, there's a very perverse backlash against science.
Yeah.
Go figure. You know, we, you know, as of about more than a year, WHO said we are no longer in a pandemic. Why? Because populations all over the world, whereas when COVID arrived, we were naive. You know, we were like Pacific Islanders who'd never seen measles. We were all naive to this new virus and it just rampaged through. Now we are not. Most of us, you know, the vast majority of people on the planet have immunity, and the vast majority of that immunity came from vaccines. So go figure the backlash against science. Go figure the backlash when we could come out of lockdowns because we had PCR tests. We had PCR tests within weeks. Do you know how long it took to get a PCR, you know, the equivalent of a PCR test for previous pandemics? You know, years.
Yep.
And so you had, you know, with AIDS, there was no test. We couldn't identify the AIDS virus. I mean, what a weapon in the arsenal. And then the rat tests. So this is, you know, it makes my mouth drop, this backlash against science, which I was hearing in these emails. A lot of it is conflated. So different policies were set across Australia by different state premiers, And there's a difference, you know, you have to build your policy on science. If you're not going to build it on science, you know, are you going to go for a flight in an airplane that, you know, is not running on the best science? I would highly advise not to. So policy has to be built on the best science. But then what do you do with those policies? Some states had more extreme lockdowns, some didn't. And I think there's been a conflation against the science. But it was really, you've got to discriminate between the science that was offered and the policy decisions that were made. And then there's the incredible misinformation. So one of the emails I got said, "But you know, Ella, we all know that the jury is out on whether mRNA vaccines did more harm than good." And I went, "What?" This was from an intelligent, educated man. My jaw dropped because, you know, I'd done the research and I knew that that wasn't the case, that the messenger RNA vaccines, they did not miss a single safety requirement. The fact that we got them out in a year was because it was like, you know, the Formula One pit stops, everybody's there going, everything is streamlined maximally fast, but no safety step is missed. So I didn't have time to go back over all the research I'd done. So I went to ChatGPT and I said, "Is it true, you know, that the mRNA vaccines caused more harm, or is the jury out?" And ChatGPT came back and said unequivocally, "No." You know? So I suggested to the person I was having an email correspondence with, I said, "Listen, you know, I did all this research while I was writing my book, but I didn't have time to do it again. So I went to ChatGPT. It's using the same process I use. It goes to the same, you know, highly, you know, the top literature, and it cross-checks between that literature. I suggest you do the same thing." So my correspondent went to his favorite AI, which happened to be, I don't know, was it Claude? And he came back to me apologetically and he said, "Yes, you're right."
Well, that's actually that's a bit of a success story in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Woo.
Yeah. Using technology, you're embracing it and changing a mind. Because that actually, one of my questions was, there's this great quote, and I'm going to take a moment to find it. It was a quote in the consciousness chapter from Daniel Kahneman. And it's to the effect that you can't really change people's minds when it's coming to the idea of science or the facts. We'll use quotation marks for the facts. Yet, when doing proper science and pursuing knowledge, that it will degenerate any erroneous theories over time. I find it reassuring that somebody can take a tool like AI and when used properly, they're able to change their mind. However, I don't have faith that the masses are able to do that right now with such noise coming from social media and, you know, these oligarchs who are these, you know, megalomaniacs and their mouthpieces. Do we have enough time right now for that process for science and knowledge to degenerate these erroneous theories? Or are we in a bit of a crisis mode, do you think?
Huge crisis mode. I mean, it's like a parallel universe, what is happening in the United States at the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, all our systems of knowledge are under attack. And, you know, I say in the book that, and this comes from Jonathan Rauch, that who's a journalist who's also at the Brookings Institute, and he wrote a wonderful book called The Constitution of Knowledge. And it really spoke to me because I wanted my book to serve as a platform more generally. And this book confirmed what I believed to be the case, that the way we create knowledge everywhere, the template is the scientific method. We gather the facts as best we can. We contest them as best as we can. And so that's the idea behind the constitution of knowledge, and that, you know, the way the law is built, the way government bureaucracies operate, the way universities operate, the way journalism operates is on that principle. Gather the facts and then test them ruthlessly, rigorously. And so I'd always assumed that, you know, these institutions would somehow be able to resist. And they've crumbled so quickly. It's breathtaking. I mean, the CIA, the FBI, the Director of National Intelligence, all institutions that I would have thought had resisted politicization, at least nominally had, have now completely politicized. Science, completely politicized. In May, Trump issued an executive order for gold standard science. Well, this is Orwellian doublespeak. Gold standard science. Well, what does that mean? I would have thought that meant what I've been describing. Gold standard science actually means that it's up to his political appointee, Michael Kratsios, to decide what is gold standard science.
So instead of a gold standard as in he can buy it with the gold.
So it's we're in a crisis moment.
You know, I've been living in Australia for 23 years, and topics of conversation that, you know, Melburnians and Australians generally, possibly I could generalize, like to talk about, of course, the, you know, whatever code of football you're living in. So they love talking about football. They love talking about the real estate and house prices, as well as the weather. But also they love talking about the foibles of the U.S. And they, in thinking that... that's somebody different, that it is different there than it is here. What risk is there that, I know, we might not have a Trump here, but Trump is the symptom, not the cause.
Yes, exactly.
How can we locally avoid that?
You know, I was mentioning my email correspondence, and the person I corresponded with, when he checked his favorite AI, he agreed to my point that no, yes, messenger RNA vaccines, yeah, they've done far more good than harm as opposed to what he thought. But nevertheless, at the end of our email thread, he said, I'm still willing to give RFK Jr. the benefit of the doubt. Okay. I think I may have said, I'm not sure why you would do that, given... nothing he's doing is based on science. We cannot be complacent.
No.
And here's a very dangerous thing. So we, of course, have our anti-vax movements here, very prevalent around the northeast coast of Australia. And I think... you know, when you erode confidence in long-held beliefs, and when it's coming from the top person in the, you know, who controls all of health, he's at the top of everything, RFK Jr., the Health and Human Services Secretary, it is filtering through here, definitely filtering through here. And... RFK is sowing doubt, huge doubt. So they already have 3 deaths from measles. They haven't had, I think, any deaths from measles for 25 years. They've got, you know, probably more than 1,000 cases. And measles is not a simple disease, as my pediatrician friend Freddie will confirm. Measles is a very dangerous illness for a baby to have. It will possibly have lifelong, and lifelong consequences. And it's not just measles. They had more than 250 deaths from flu in children this year. So RFK, and they've got a whooping cough outbreak. So RFK is slowly eroding at confidence. And we have our anti-vaxxers here. And then we have the parents who just sort of sit in the middle. Mm-hmm. Well, should I or shouldn't I? They follow their tribal views on Facebook. They follow their influences. And we will see more of them thinking, well, maybe I don't need to vaccinate. We will see more flu deaths in children. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we have a huge problem with misinformation.
I think it's time to see if there's any questions. There's a lot of food for thought that you've given us. I highly recommend, obviously, this is read the book because it will get you thinking about these things even more. But does our audience have any questions for Elizabeth Lynn?
Up until very recently, I coordinated a subject called Bad Science, where we stole the name Shining You from Van Gogh's book. We talked about practice of science by using pathological science as an example. That's gone by the wayside. It was a victim of rationalization, you know, erythrotrope. But we think it's important, and obviously thank you for writing a book on this topic. How do we advocate better for this kind of thing to be included in curricula? And how do we encourage our students to be the healthy kind of skeptics, not obligate contrarianists, but people who ask the right sorts of questions and have that set of tools that allows them to sift through facts from fiction?
You know, I really think the book is a good start. No, I realise there's a conflict of interests here. But I've had several of my friends who are scientists, Robin Baderham, one of them, who was a chief scientist, give me feedback saying, you know, I'll put in my own words, as scientists, we've been centipedes, but do we contemplate the workings of our 100 legs? And that's what this book was for me. I think it was a revelation, truly. I've spent my whole life in science as a research scientist, then as a science writer, then as an editor. And I never contemplated the philosophy of science, but I had to contemplate the philosophy of science in this book. And it's been quite a revelation to me that we go back to Socrates, who in his dialogues with Plato Plato records Socrates' dialogues. We never hear Socrates' own voice. We only hear his voice secondhand from his student Plato. And Plato uses the device of the dialogues, where Socrates will grab some youngster and sort of start a conversation with them and methodically unearth all their sort of philosophical errors. And Socrates lays down all the problems. We can't trust our senses, and we can't trust authorities. And he lays down all the problems up for how we acquire knowledge. Scientific revolution comes along 2,000 years later, and it's an answer to Socrates. And Newton is the hero of the scientific revolution because he says, look, it's about the data I can deliver, the maths, and the extent to which I can test it. It's beautifully captured by the Royal Society's motto, nullius in verba, take nobody's word for it. Test, test, test. And I think this for me was like, oh yes, this is true. This is what it was like to be a scientist. And I hadn't realised that until I'd gone on this journey and across all these different areas of science. So I think it is instructive students of scientists to take them back to their pedigree. And this book showed me the pedigree of modern science, that it begins with Socrates. Newton starts to deliver some of the answers. Newton inspires David Hume, who thinks, well, this is great, but, you know, there's a problem in inducing laws of the universe. Just because it's happened a million times doesn't mean it'll happen a million and one times. David Hume inspires Einstein, and Einstein realizes, well, these are the problems with induction. You know, we solve it by statistics, basically. But it doesn't mean that a meter's always got to be a meter and a second's always got to be. Einstein inspires Karl Popper, because Einstein, for all his mad theories, getting up there and saying, according to my theory of relativity, a meter is not always a meter and a second is not always a second, he also says, you can test my theory. Einstein provides tests for all his theories, for his crazy theory of gravity that says the fabric of the universe is space-time and it's stretchy like Lycra. He says, go away and test it during an eclipse. And they do test it. Arthur Eddington tests it and he realizes, oh my God, Einstein was right. Do we accept it? No, we keep retesting and retesting and retesting.
Fantastic. Question right up here.
Yeah. How much should scientists be involved with the decision-making of his clients and the public?
You know, I think Katie Allen gave me a nice metaphor. Katie Allen was in the Morrison government, and Katie is a paediatrician and an eminent researcher. And she was asked during the pandemic, because, you know, it was Morrison government for most of the pandemic, all of the pandemic, how policymakers should be influenced by the science. And Katie's answer was this. Look, let's say I'm on a plane. Somebody says, we need a doctor. This guy's having a heart attack. I examine the person. And then I give my best advice to the pilot. And I say, look, this person, if they're not, you know, on the ground within 1 hour, it will very likely die. Can I tell that pilot they must land? I cannot. I can only offer the best advice, but then I have to leave it to the pilot's decision. And that, because they are integrating many factors, not the least, how much fuel they've got. You know, is it safe to land anywhere within an hour? Are they in a, you know, flying over, you know, a military conflict? I think that was the best way. I thought that was a good answer. I think scientists themselves should not politicize themselves. I think they have to stay scientists. They must give the best understanding at that moment in time, with the qualifications, with the, you know, confidence intervals, with the caveats.
If the person said there's an 80% chance of this or a 99% chance of it, this would be influencing the decision makers.
Well, you would hope so.
If it's rooted in science, I'd imagine. Speak with authority. Yeah.
What else are you going to base it on if not science? The whims.
I had a 99% chance of dying tomorrow, I'd fix up all my accounts today. That's for sure.
And be very happy the next day if you proved the statistic wrong.
Doesn't matter, because I can always reverse them.
Fantastic.
Quick
question, yeah? Well, yes.
Theory always be a theory until you can prove it. So they become a science, right? Just like you said about quantum physics, about Einstein, something like that. So many things still need to prove it. Entanglement, uncertainty, consensus, like I said. Okay, that one we have to follow. But we got in COVID, we have two directions to prove it. One, it study the virus information. That means science, the what they form and where and how they develop and whatever. That will be in the lab, right? The second way is you study the timeline. What happened to what when the virus spread in China, it before that or after that? That's the investigation. The two ways to do.
So you mean, did the virus start in China or did the virus start outside China? Is that what you mean?
One, you design the lab to study the virus.
Yes.
One, you investigation,
Yes.
The investigation where they come out first. First place the virus come out.
So I think you're talking about exactly that first chapter in Elizabeth's book, that the competing theories of a lab origin of the virus or a wild origin.
But before the early day of the COVID, I read many documents about it. They study about the virus. That's the way they say they come from nature, something like that.
Yes.
And after that, the CIA jump in, and Fauci jump in, Gang of Pension jump in, the political motivate, and then they become a lab leak or something like that. And why they don't tell the lab leak before?
I think, you know, the first SARS in 2002, they traced it to a wet market where they sold wildlife in Guangdong. Yeah. And so nobody challenged it because they found the civets that they had the earliest type of the virus before it spread widely into the human population. So open and shut case. It came from the civets, and then the civets were sold in restaurants in Hong Kong, I think, and they, you know, civet and snake soup, it was a delicacy, and then they traced it back that way. In the early days of 2020, when they have SARS-2, the first cases were from the wet market, Hunan wet market. The Chinese authorities on January the 1st, they closed down the market. They knew the first SARS started a market. They saw the first cases were coming again from the Huanan seafood market, so they closed it down. So they didn't have any doubt. They sterilized, they closed it down. And then where did those wild animals come from? They came from the surrounding wildlife farms, and a law was passed making it illegal, the wildlife trading. For eating the animals. So in those early days, they didn't have any doubt. And then really it was the scientists, when they read the code of the virus, and they said, look, these two little strange signatures, it could have been made in a lab. So really it was the scientists in Australia, in America, who said, could be. But then they changed their mind because they found the virus in the pangolin had the same signature, and that the evidence was that if it was genetically engineered, it probably wouldn't have that second signature. So they changed their mind. But the conspiracy theory grew and wouldn't go away. And then scientifically you had to say, look, it could have begun in a lab. We know that the Wuhan Institute of Virology, their job was to collect all the coronaviruses from the bats. That's why they were started, because the whole world was terrified about the next SARS. But they'd had the experience in 2002. They didn't want another experience like that. And the best defense is knowledge, right? So you collect the viruses from the bat caves. In Yunnan province, they found that's where most of the new viruses were evolving. And they tested them in the lab. Is anything dangerous happening? And we know that laboratory experiments can go wrong. So it was possible. It could have come from the lab. And then many scientists said, look, you dismissed the lab origin too quickly. We have to go back and check it again. So Michael Warraby, another scientist, He took a different approach, because the first cases, I said, most of them came from people who worked at the market, but then a third of the cases came from the market, but two-thirds didn't work on the market, at the market. Sorry, didn't work at the market. So the question was, maybe those people lived somewhere that would give us a clue to the origins. So Michael Warraby got the data on the first 150 cases, not where they worked, but where did they live. And he came up with an extraordinary finding. So if you're familiar with the city of Wuhan, it's a huge city, like Melbourne, but 12 million people, more than double the population. And lots of wet markets, lots of malls, very dense population. Those first 150 cases, you know where those people lived? The Huanan Seafood Market. If you put a dot here, the highest density of cases was around the market. The next highest density was a little further out. It was like a contour map, only around the Huanan Seafood Market. This is astonishing evidence.
I think we had a miner, they mining somewhere very remote area, and they found him there. They got the virus, and he never come to the market. He never know about the market or whatever.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll have to take a,
The Mojang mine, you mean.
So yeah. How
can you prove it? Well,
the market.
I think because we haven't found an animal from the market, we found the DNA from the market. In the market, those stalls that were selling civets and raccoon dogs, which are animals that can be infected by the virus, those were the stalls which had the highest concentration of SARS-CoV-2. So there's lots and lots of evidence, but until we couldn't go in there because they shut down the market and all the animals disappeared. So you, unlike the first SARS, you couldn't go in there and pull out an animal and say, look, it's got the virus. So you can't prove it.
I think bottom line. Time for only one more question. Elizabeth, sorry, we'll have to probably be fairly quick, but final question right here.
Do you think we could do a better job of training young children in a real scientific method, in a way that would make it okay to be wrong? I remember the Academy's science education project. A very important part of that was to get the kids to make hypotheses about simple things, will this ball float or sink? Is the sea dead or alive? And get the kids, before they actually do any experiments, get them to say what they think it's going to happen. And of course, some of them will have crazy ideas, and then they'll find out they're wrong. And that's okay. Is there some way we could change the way science is taught?
I couldn't agree with you more wholeheartedly. That's how I raised my children, to believe that the question is more important than the answer. And, I think scientific method is intuitive. And can it be formalized? Yes, absolutely. To get that framework. Well, I hope the Academy's influence is still there. How to do it? I think it's straightforward, as you've described, to do it. I think maybe we just need to disseminate that modality, that way of thinking, to teachers. I think education is very responsive to new ideas, isn't it? Maybe we can.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So thank you so very much, Elizabeth, for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. That it could be.
I kind of want to. We had a quick conversation before this, and I asked about, as any artist, they always have to, what I say, kill a darling. Leave some, whether you're a filmmaker putting film on the floor, cutting those clips, or a painter who just has to abandon it and maybe not do the subject that they really want. Did you have to trim something? Is there some sort of story that there's left to tell with Prove It?
So I have two answers. Number one, my editor was quite ruthless about cutting, and I'm glad she did it, because I think as a writer, you just become too attached to stuff. So now I think I'm glad she did that, because you want people to read your book and they just simply cannot go down every rabbit hole with you, that, you know, that you as the writer, you've given yourself the luxury of going down every rabbit hole. And I think that's the joy of writing a book. One of the questions you asked me early on was, you know, if I had used AI, which I didn't, you know, would my process have been different? And absolutely, because I went down so many rabbit holes, and I'm glad I did, and it really enriched what I came back with. The darlings I've had to kill is there were chapters I still wanted to write, but after 5.5 years, I said, okay. I had so much energy for my first chapter, which was on gravitational waves. By the end, I was really limping. So I wanted to do a chapter on ice ages. I mean, the data on climate change is, you know, 99.9999% clear for the last 100, 200 years. But I found that ice ages kept creeping into my chapters, especially on human origin. All the key stages of human evolution are referenced with respect to what was happening in climate. We came out of Africa 60,000 years ago when there was a little, you know, step back in the ice ages. So I thought, what? I really don't understand why we keep having these cycles of ice ages every 100,000 years. So I didn't get to that one. And that would have been my chance to go get into some serious geology and climatology. So that will be for volume two. I really wanted to get into the standard model, which is what is the universe really made of? You know, all the subatomic particles and, you know, quarks and muons. And so ran out of time for that.
So I took a look at the faces and people were like, oh, that's a big one. So, yeah, there's some big thinking there.
Dark energy, I think, is a fascinating one from the point of view of philosophy of science.
Well, fantastic.
Yeah.
So I highly recommend that everybody do read, pick up a copy of Prove It. And I so much looking forward to possibly the second edition. Prove It Again. I don't know.
You've been listening to Literary Latrobe, a Latrobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Jajawarong and Tuggerong country. You can find out more about this podcast and other Latrobe podcasts on the Latrobe University website.